Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the black community. This week, I have readings about a change in ownership at a website from Blavity.com, an opinion piece about the black national anthem from the Philadelphia Daily News, a story about Kentucky farmers from the website NextCity.com. I'll have two selections from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, an interview with the creator of a museum, and a story about how families relate to southern plantations that still exist. And I'm starting with this story about government layoffs, titled, Overwhelmingly White Administration Dismissing High-Ranking Black Officials. This was written by Erica Green and published Sunday, October 12, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Robert Primus, the first black board chair of the federal regulator responsible for approving railroad mergers, at first thought there was something wrong with his work phone. When he couldn't unlock it, he switched to his personal phone, only to learn that President Donald Trump had fired him by email, effective immediately. "I didn't see it coming at all," Primus, a Democrat, said in a recent interview. In January, the Trump administration had put a Republican in his place as the chair of the Surface Transportation Board, which Primus saw as the president's prerogative. But he had been appointed to the independent board by Trump in his first term and expected to remain on it, as had been the long-standing practice. Instead, he heard a White House spokesperson say the day after his firing in August that he did not align with the president's agenda. Primus, a longtime congressional staff member and former lobbyist on transportation and national security matters, was reminded, he said, of Trump's widely condemned comment during the 2024 campaign that immigrants were taking black jobs. "Maybe he felt that this job was not intended for blacks," said Primus, 55. He acknowledged he was speculating, he said, "but it's legitimate speculation, because if you look across the board, there is a pattern." Primus is part of a series of firings of black officials from high-profile positions in an overwhelmingly white administration that has banished all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs across the federal government. And while there are no statistics on firing by race, an examination of the people Trump is appointing to fill those and other jobs shows a stark trend. Of the president's 98 Senate-confirmed appointees to the administration's most senior leadership roles in its first 200 days ending on August 7th, only two, Scott Turner, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and Earl Matthews, the Defense Department's general counsel, are black. The statistics were compiled for the Brookings Institution by Catherine Dunn Tempus, a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, who specializes in presidential personnel. The statistics track appointments to the 15 cabinet departments in the presidential line of succession: Treasury, Defense, Justice, Homeland Security, Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Energy, Health and Human Services, Transportation, Housing and Urban Development, and Veterans Affairs. Trump seemed to be very proud to have Blacks for Trump at all of his rallies and behind the podium, but not behind him in the cabinet meeting, said Derek Asante Muhammad, president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, a think tank that tracks black representation in government leadership, among other markers. The dearth of black people at the top, he said, would result in radical, substantive policy changes for African Americans. "When we're not in the room," he said, "things don't tend to go better for us." Trump's highest profile firing of a senior black leader was in February, when he ousted General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., the second black chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the nation's senior military official. Joint Chiefs chairs traditionally remain in place as administrations change, regardless of the president's party. And in 2020, Trump had nominated Brown, a fighter pilot, to be the Air Force's chief of staff. But Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth previously had said that Brown should be fired because of a woke focus on DEI programs in the military and questioned whether he was promoted because of his race. Brown was replaced with a little-known Air Force general, Dan Kane. The president has fired other black officials like Primus from top jobs at government agencies and independent boards that typically serve multiple administrations. Those terminated include Carla Hayden, the first African-American and first woman to be the Librarian of Congress, Gwen Wilcox, the first black woman to serve as a member of the National Labor Relations Board, and Alvin Brown, the only black member of the National Transportation Safety Board at the time of his removal. Willie Phillips, the first black person to be the chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, stepped down from his position in April at the request of the White House. The president has since nominated David Lassert to replace him. Trump has tried to fire Lisa Cook, the first black woman to serve on the Fed's Board of Governors, but she has sued to stop him. Last week, the Supreme Court declined to allow Trump to immediately remove her and said it would review his efforts to oust her at oral arguments in January. Primus, Brown, and Wilcox also have filed lawsuits asking to be reinstated. Brown, Hayden, and Phillips have been replaced by white men. A white man has been nominated to replace Brown, and two white men have been nominated to fill seats on the Labor Relations Board after Wilcox was fired. Primus and Cook have not yet been replaced. You don't need a very sophisticated analysis to read into what this means, said Kathy Albisa, the former vice president at Race Forward, a nonprofit that promotes racial equity in government. Albisa now runs an organization, Branch 4, spell B-R-A-N-C-H, the number 4, supporting federal workers. It is a resegregation of the workforce and an attack on the black middle class. In the first Trump administration, there were fewer high-profile firings of black workers, but there was only one black official, Ben Carson, the housing secretary, among the 70 Senate-confirmed nominees to the major government departments in the first 200 days. Carson returned to the administration last month as an advisor to the Agriculture Department. In the same 200-day period for previous presidents, according to Brookings, black officials accounted for 21% of Senate-confirmed nominees under President Joe Biden, 13% under President Barack Obama, and 8% under President George W. Bush. Black Americans make up about 14% of the U.S. population. A White House spokesperson, Kush Desai, rejected criticism that Trump was undermining black Americans, but he did not address the lack of diversity in appointments. President Trump pledged to build a government and economy that works for every American, and the administration is hard at work restoring the historic private sector job, wage, and economic growth that Americans, including black Americans, enjoyed during his first term, Desai said. Trump informed Wilcox in a late-night email on January 27th that she was being removed from her position on the Labor Relations Board, effective immediately. No cause was given. It was the beginning of the administration's test of the boundaries of the president's power over independent agencies. Wilcox, a Democrat and former union lawyer, was the first board member in its 90-year history to be removed by a president. A week before, in the very first hours of his administration, Trump had signed an executive order calling for an end to DEI programs and the termination of all discriminatory programs in the government, including in federal employment practices. We had targets on our backs, no doubt about it, by virtue of the color of our skin, Wilcox, 72, said in an interview. But I did not get this job because of DEI. I got it because of my experience. Since then, she has fought her firing, calling it unlawful and unprecedented. In April, the Supreme Court ruled that Trump could temporarily remove her while her challenge goes forward. Wilcox said she was not thinking about breaking racial barriers when she accepted the appointment, nor did race play a role in how she decided cases. I made decisions based on my application of the National Labor Relations Act to the facts presented in each case assigned, she said. She worried about the work that has halted as a result of her removal. Only one board member remains, and without a quorum of three, the board cannot resolve cases. American workers who are awaiting decisions on issues like reinstatements and back pay after being unlawfully terminated, suspended, or laid off have had their lives hanging in the balance. I don't know what the Supreme Court will decide, Wilcox said, but I had to fight this, not just for me, but for working people, including those who have had cases before the NLRB, and to fight for the agency. Black workers, particularly black women, have been hard hit by reductions in the federal workforce overall. According to a New York Times tracker of Trump's cuts, agencies where racial minorities and women were a majority of the workforce, such as the Education Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, were targeted for the largest workforce reductions or complete elimination. Black women made up nearly a quarter of the workforce in agencies such as the IRS, which also saw deep reductions according to a Times analysis. Hayden did not see her firing coming either. The Librarian of Congress, who was appointed a decade ago by Obama as the 14th person in the role since its creation in 1802, was at her mother's home in Baltimore on a Thursday evening in May. "I was there a little early, like 6:30," she told author and producer Kwame Alexander in a conversation on stage at the annual convention of the American Library Association in June. "So a little happy hour, you know? TV's on in our den, and I'm looking at the phones and stuff, and I see this text." Hayden, 73, who is now a senior fellow at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, declined to be interviewed by the Times. But she spoke openly about her firing at the Library Association convention. The text message, she told Alexander and the crowd, was two sentences addressed casually to Carla, from someone she had never heard of. "On behalf of President Donald J. Trump, I am writing to inform you that your position as the Librarian of Congress is terminated effective immediately," read the text from Trent Morse, the Deputy Director of White House Personnel. "Thank you for your service." Trump has appointed Todd Blanche, the Deputy Attorney General and his former lawyer, as the Acting Librarian of Congress. The day after Hayden's ouster, she learned from a briefing by the White House Press Secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, that her dismissal was the result of unspecified, concerning things that she had done at the Library of Congress in the pursuit of DEI, including allowing inappropriate books in the library for children. The Library of Congress, the largest library in the world, is the main research arm of Congress and also provides scholars access to its vast collections. It does not lend books to children or adults. "I must say," Hayden said wryly of Leavitt's remark, "it has been interesting." That was the article, "Overwhelmingly White Administration Dismissing High-Ranking Black Officials." This was written by Erica Green and published October 12, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. My next reading is about one of the websites I use to get information for this program. The title is, "The Root is Black-Owned Once Again, as CNN Commentator Ashley Allison Acquires Publication." This was written by Jehora Michelle and published October 2, 2025, at the website Blavity.com. The Root, R-O-O-T, a prominent black media outlet known for its coverage of black issues, is set to have changes in its ownership. CNN reported that Ashley Allison, the network's political strategist and commentator, announced Thursday, October 9th, that she would be acquiring The Root from GO Media, a digital media holding company controlled by a private equity firm. The Root represents the first major investment for Watering Hole Media, the company Allison founded last year. Terms of the deal were not disclosed, according to CNN. Allison outlined the changes readers can expect, including expanded video content, partnerships with experts, and in-person experiences. The move also marks the first time in years that the media outlet will operate under black ownership. "This isn't about making more content, but rather about making meaning of this moment," Allison said, noting the challenges the media faces in the current political climate. when journalism is under attack and audiences are seeking independent sources for news. Allison said The Root has always been about preserving culture and creating clarity in a world full of distractions. Owning the power to tell our own stories is a rich tradition The Root is committed to upholding, Allison said. Allison also serves as an organizer and advocate with over 15 years of experience in campaigns and civil work, according to her Harvard profile. She has served as a senior staffer for the Obama-Biden administration and the Biden-Harris 2020 campaign. Allison has also held leadership roles at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. According to the Columbia Journal Review, The Root was founded in 2008 by Donald Graham, chairman of the Washington Post Company, and Henry Louis Gates, Jr., director of the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African-American Research at Harvard. They aim to focus on social, cultural, and political issues through the African-American lens. The Root will be a 21st century version of a national black newspaper, The Post reported at the launch, per CNN. In 2015, The Root was bought by Univision, which later sold it to private equity firm Great Hill Partners in 2019. Under GO Media, the site remained the company's only major title after other properties such as Lifehacker, The Onion, and Kotaku were sold. That was the article, The Root is Black-Owned Once Again, as CNN commentator Ashley Allison acquires publication. This was written by Jahora Michelle and published October 2, 2025, at the website Blavity.com. Next, an opinion piece from the Philadelphia Daily News newspaper about the performance of the Black National Anthem before some NFL games. The title is, Black History and Culture Deserve Better Than Those Cringeworthy Moments at the Link. This was written by Rand Miller and published September 10, 2025. Opening night at Lincoln Financial Field was a moment in time for celebration. It started with the unfurling of a championship banner commemorating the Eagles' victory in Super Bowl 59 in February, and the Birds went on to beat the hated Dallas Cowboys. However, some of the more memorable moments of the evening were cringeworthy. Just about everyone at the game was talking about how Eagles defensive tackle Jalen Carter was ejected for spitting on Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott, and the Birds' defense suffered as a result. But what really caught my attention was the lack of respect shown during the singing of the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, and it was glaring. The moment of fans' disregard, marked by boos, was so glaring that it was also noted in social media, sports talk radio, and international media. In light of the war on black history, the singing of Lift Every Voice and Sing at public events offers the opportunity for a teachable moment, and we need more teachable moments about black history. Without an understanding of black history and the nuances that make up our community's lived experiences, it is difficult to appreciate the cultural significance of black touchpoints and moments like the Black National Anthem. Sung in black communities far and wide, Lift Every Voice and Sing was written in 1900 by James Weldon Johnson, a public school principal in Jacksonville, Florida, who wanted to honor the black experience in America, particularly surviving slavery and Jim Crow. In the African American community, many folks know our national anthem, yes, I wrote our, as well as or better than we know the Star-Spangled Banner. Had Dreams and Nightmares or any well-known hip-hop song been played in a similar context, it's not hard to imagine stadium-going white folks and other non-black people seen twerking and throwing up fake gang signs while bopping to the beat. After all, those behaviors are what many people believe is the totality of black culture. That's because, since at least the birth of minstrel shows in the early 19th century, mocking black people and black culture is an American pastime. Anti-black racism isn't anything new. Neither is the attempt to silence its retelling in classrooms, books, and museums. Teaching Black history is essential to curb ignorance and foster understanding, but giving American access to Black culture is not, especially when doing so invites a level of disrespect, disregard, and bastardization of what we hold sacred. Opening night was an example of this. But it's time we put an end to opening ourselves up to disrespect. It's time to stop performing Lift Every Voice and Sing at NFL games. Paradoxically, doing so only ends up reiterating the narrative that Black history isn't worth our attention. And that is not merely cringeworthy, but false. There's one image that goes along with this commentary. It shows three members of the R&B group Boyz II Men, decked out in Philadelphia Eagles football jerseys, singing Lift Every Voice and Sing. Behind them are five members of a Philadelphia Police Department color guard, dressed in blue shirts with blue caps. Three are holding flags, two are holding rifles. The flags being presented are the American flag, the Philadelphia flag, and the flag that represents those individuals that are prisoners of war or missing in action. That was the opinion piece by Rand Miller, titled, Black History and Culture Deserve Better Than Those Cringeworthy Moments at the Link. This was published in the Philadelphia Daily News, September 10, 2025. My next reading is a one-on-one interview from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The title is, Civil Rights Lawyer, Here's How to Tell U.S. Story. This was written by Kurt Streeter and published October 12, 2025. As the Trump administration attempts to remove exhibits focused on race and slavery from national parks and reviews the Smithsonian Institution's approach to history, cultural institutions are struggling with how best to respond. Brian Stevenson, 65, is a civil rights lawyer and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit law group that represents imprisoned and condemned inmates. He has a message for those cultural institutions. Expand your efforts. Don't retreat. We dishonor those who came before us if in this moment of crisis we remain silent, Stevenson said. I don't think it's just unempathetic. I don't think it's just cowardly. I think it's dishonorable. Stevenson, whose memoir, Just Mercy, became a movie of the same name, has helped transform Montgomery, Alabama into a global destination for reckoning with the nation's racial past. His EJI legacy sites, museums and monuments focused on racial justice, have drawn more than 2 million visitors. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice features 805 steel monuments hanging suspended, each bearing the names of lynching victims from a different county. Visitors walk beneath them in silence, confronted by the weight of terror. Nearby, the Legacy Museum takes visitors through the journey from enslavement to mass incarceration. His newest site, the Freedom Monument Sculpture Park, opened in March 2024 on 17 acres, featuring work from more than 24 artists and a towering national monument to freedom, a 43-foot-tall wall inscribed with 122,000 surnames adopted by formerly enslaved people listed in the 1870 census. The park opened the same week Alabama banned teaching divisive concepts about race in public schools and universities. The Equal Justice Initiative's latest project, the Elevation Hotel, was designed as a sanctuary for visitors engaging with this difficult history. I interviewed Stevenson recently in Montgomery as he walked through the sites and prepared for the hotel's Wednesday opening. This conversation has been edited and condensed. Atlanta Journal-Constitution. How would you describe the environment for cultural institutions engaged in telling the unvarnished story of our nation's racial history now? Stevenson. I see the administration's attempt to review and remove exhibits as proof that our work is critically important. I feel incredibly lucky that we're 8 years into establishing our major public history sites and cultural work. If we were just starting this effort, it would be too late to successfully fight back against this political push to erase certain difficult or inconvenient historical truths. Atlanta Journal-Constitution. If you could bring Donald Trump to Montgomery right now, which of your sites would you take him to, and what specific truth would you want him to confront? Stevenson. I would take him through the museum, just so he could understand the connection between what happened during the transatlantic slave trade and today. It's so interesting when he says, "Stop talking about how bad slavery was." He thinks of himself as being anti-crime and tough on criminals. Well, kidnapping 13 million people is a crime. It was a crime in the 15th century. There's never been a time in human history where kidnapping was seen as acceptable. We're talking about crime victims who weren't just victimized for a day or a week. They were victimized for their whole lives. He would never say to the people who lost loved ones on 9/11, "Oh, you guys should stop talking about what happened on 9/11. He did the opposite. I want him to understand that what black people went through is the exact same thing, except we never got comforted. We never got embraced. And I would bring him to the lynching memorial because the people who were lynching black people thought they were keeping the white community safe. This will send a very strong message about where that path leads. Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Given the threats to federal funding and political scrutiny, what is the responsibility right now of cultural institutions focused on the black experience and marginalized histories? Stevenson. We're going to have to do things that are uncomfortable. Given the knowledge and the resources and the privileges that so many of us have, we can't afford to hope somebody else does the truth-telling for us. We didn't take any federal funding at our sites. You can get philanthropic support. You don't have to take federal money. And if the federal government is involved and tries to take away the essence of these cultural institutions, I would advise them to tell the government, keep your money. I keep giving these talks and I say, they may try to take away our 501c3 tax status, which would be devastating. But I would rather be a truth teller and taxed than be silent and untaxed. The room is usually just dead quiet, but I really feel that way. To bend would also dishonor the legacy of those who did not bend. You got to stand, even when people say sit down. Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Inside the Legacy Museum, visitors are surrounded by harrowing evidence, including the newspaper headlines celebrating lynchings and the audio testimonies of the wrongly condemned. How do you respond to the argument that we should not focus on this brutal graphic history? Stevenson. You have to be privileged and protected to go through life only thinking positive thoughts. It's like saying, "I'm going to the doctor, but I've already instructed my doctor, don't give me any bad news." If your doctor isn't allowed to be truthful with you, you're going to get sick and you're going to die prematurely. So if you don't want to be sick, if you don't want to die, you have to be willing to hear the truth about your condition. If we have the courage to hear the truth of this, there are things we can do to recover from this history of violence. It begins by committing to being against violence, being committed to the rule of law, to actually educating people about what happens when you give in to fear and anger. Even in relationships, if you want to be in a good, healthy relationship, if you make a mistake and your partner is forbidden from giving voice to that, you're just going to breed resentment and hostility. I just think that applies to history. Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You describe yourself and your historic sites as being part of a wider narrative struggle over telling the nation's story. What do you mean by that? Stevenson. I do think we're in the midst of a narrative struggle. We won the deconstruction of legal apartheid. Now we're in a moment where I think the battle is a narrative battle. We can no longer rely on the rule of law alone. We have to engage in the storytelling the teaching that helps this country recognize why we are still in a struggle for equality and justice. That was the interview titled, Civil Rights Lawyer, Here's How to Tell U.S. Story. This was written by Kurt Streeter and published October 12, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading on today's African American Hour is titled, What It Takes to Keep Kentucky's Black-Led Farms Alive. This was published in the NextCity.com website. It was written by Annabelle Peterman and published September 26, 2025. Near the eastern edge of Fayette County, Kentucky, sits the Coleman Crest Farm in the rural black hamlet of Uttingertown. That's where Jim Coleman works the land his great-grandfather tilled as an enslaved person, until he secured his freedom by fighting in the Civil War and returning to purchase the farm more than 130 years ago. Now, Coleman is continuing his family's farming legacy, but not because it's easy work. Yesterday I was pulling up mulch, Coleman says, in between administrative calls. I had harvested hard the day before, did a little bit of harvesting yesterday, invoiced it, packaged it, put it in my truck, drove to my customer and delivered. Coleman's 13-acre plot is one of few in the county, and in Kentucky, that's still black-owned and operated. And among all farmers, the sheer volume of farmland has fallen, statewide and nationwide. The average age of farmers is 58 years old. They're burnt out. They're debt-ridden. Their kids don't want in, Coleman says. And you've got a developer knocking on your door saying, listen, I've got $50,000 an acre. He explains the first thing such a farmer might think, $50,000? I could sell this thing or maybe a portion of it, pay off my debts and get a life. USDA programs intended to level the playing field have been slashed under the current administration. That includes the socially disadvantaged designation in the 1990 Farm Bill, which directed resources to farmers that historically faced lending discrimination. The decision ruled that the consequences of racial discrimination had been sufficiently addressed. Meanwhile, black farm ownership in Kentucky has shrunk dramatically in the last century, about 650 owners compared to some 100,000 white farm owners, according to the most recent USDA agricultural census. That proportion lies far below the national average of 1.4%. The total number of black producers nationally also decreased by 4% between 2017 and 2022. Facing the threat of urban development and losses of federal support, how can black producers' farms and legacies survive and grow in Kentucky? Local regulations such as Lexington-Fayette County's Purchase of Development Rights Program have the opportunity to help. But some black leaders say this support is not yet reaching those who need it most. In the meantime, black-led organizations like Black Soil are serving as a resource and partner to Kentucky's black farmers. Like many states, Kentucky has developed government programs to help offer farmers financial benefit while preserving their land's farmland status, though the Commonwealth's are less robust than its neighbors. The Kentucky Department of Agriculture preserves about 200 farms through the Purchase of Agricultural Conservation Easement Corporation, which only accepted donated land. And nonprofits like the Bluegrass Land Conservancy, also based in Lexington, provide tax deductions for landowners willing to enter their network. Lexington Fayette is one of the few municipalities nationwide that offers an alternative, direct purchase of these development rights. The city-county government adopted its Purchase of Development Rights, PDR, program 25 years ago, modeled after other easement programs like the Bluegrass Land Conservancy. Only tracts of land 20 acres or larger have been eligible until this year. When the office kickstarted its Small Farm Conservation Program, the new subset of PDR allows 10 to 19 acre farms to enter easements. We thought, oh, maybe we'll get 5 or 10 applications. And we got 37, says Beth Overman, the director of Lexington's PDR office. That was after spreading news about the small farm program through word of mouth as a test run. The city and office then process and score these applications. As of late 2025, more than 33,000 acres of land are under PDR easements, nearing their 50,000-acre goal. Their next application period opens later in the year, and officials plan to get the word out through council members and mail advertisements. The new rules open up an opportunity. Black farmers nationwide tend to own smaller acreage farms and see lower revenue. They now have the option to sell the development rights of their 10-plus acre farms. They receive that value in cash, useful for purchasing new equipment or staying afloat while keeping ownership of their farm. Developers then can't buy it out for industrialization, helping the farmland stay in their families and communities. With the small farm program, once word is out and people know it's there, then that minority farmer who maybe has 5 acres or 0 acres, knowing that they could put the farm into the small farm program and get a little cash back, may help them think, I could maybe take this jump and try to start my own farm, Overman says. Lexington's PDR program is a one-person office, and Overman says the lack of manpower and resources affects what they are able to do. Maybe that's a place we could get to someday. It could help people take the plunge to buy a farm if they knew, Overman added. The pieces are all there, ready to be put together. On paper, it works. In reality, the founder of Lexington-based nonprofit agribusiness Black Soil says this potential has gone unrealized for the region's most vulnerable producers, farmers in black rural hamlets. The PDR program needs to do a lot more outreach in educating folks in the rural hamlets, technical assistance, as well as the outreach to let people know, says Ashley C. Smith, who came to agriculture as an adult and launched Black Soil in 2017. Her organization supports Kentucky black farmers and runs fresh food markets in Lexington, connecting food insecure residents to produce and meat from black farmers at below market rates. In her time running the organization, she has worked extensively with urban black farmers in the city's denser neighborhoods, as well as rural growers in areas like Utteringtown and beyond state lines. Smith argues that information about local agriculture programs like PDR isn't disseminated effectively, a consequence of systemic racism throughout the industry. Black Soil acts as a mirror. If we are able to find this many black farmers in our region, farmers, culinary artists, industry professionals, then there's an active choice to not see people. Coleman sits on the Rural Land Management Board, which oversees the PDR program. That means his own farm is ineligible, but he agrees the program isn't reaching those who need it most. No one in that room knows about the PDR program, Coleman says. PDRs are very transformative, and I think the right way to go. It can't help if you don't know. The Cleve Family Market isn't eligible for purchase development rights either, because it's not in Fayette County. The family farm straddles the central time zone border in rural Bonnieville, about an hour south of metropolitan Louisville, and just under 2 hours from Lexington. What I want y'all to get from this is you can start today, farmer Travis Cleaver says, motioning to the chicken coop behind him. The sun beat down on dozens of professional and aspiring growers as his fellow farm employees explained how each broiler chicken needs one more square foot every week they grow. These are scrap materials we found around the barn and scraped together. As you get better, you buy better. The Cleve Family Market was one of multiple destinations in the State of the Soil Conference, hosted by Black Soil. Guests traveled from states nearby to hear from industry professionals, tour farms across central Kentucky, and network with agriculturalists of all walks. Local black growers and chefs produced most of the food, too. Instead of rallying all farmers and digging into folks who want to farm, people are trying to work to ostracize and undermine and minimize. But thankfully, those farmers are resilient and they stuck together, Smith says. Cleaver walked attendees through the fine details of crop and livestock production. Their leafy greens use drip tape instead of pipe, and the white plastic covering the soil regulate its temperature in the hot months. His father bought the farm in 1980, continuing the legacy Travis's great-grandfather began. Now they operate it together with knowledge gained through generations of farming communities. For rural black farmers especially, Cleaver says it's already hard enough to get the land. His job now is to be a good steward. I know the sacrifice that my parents made to get this in a time when it wasn't easy to get it. Whether it be interest rates, whether it be injustices, whether it be lack of wages, lack of know-how. Black Soil invests funds into black-owned farming operations, helps growers find grants, and then places their produce and meat on local shelves. The Cleve Family Market seasonal produce appears in Black Soil's Lexington markets, bolstering access to fresh food for urban residents' offerings as well as Cleve Family's market's revenue. It's part of Black Soil's mission of empowering black-owned farms in the face of historic and continued oppression and exclusion. We always say we're a ladder. They're standing on our shoulders, and we're standing on their shoulders. And together, we can keep this thing where it's all over the state, Cleaver says. Just getting good food to good people. Black Soil Smith says their work to create a structured support for black farmers came with plenty of opposition. It included what she says were unnecessary appeals, losses in data, and industry professionals treating black farmers' produce as dirty. We had to create our own sidewalk. We really had to pour the concrete, get in there, and smooth it out and say, okay, now we're gonna walk right there. We had to sidestep people because they kept standing in our way, Smith says. I can only imagine the heaping feeling upon farmers whose products are being indirectly insulted from agribusiness, designed to help the farmers that they aren't helping. Black Soil is also one of Coleman Crest Farm's primary collaborators. Coleman says the organization's help has been invaluable because its mission was built with the needs of black farmers at the front. It helps to give us the revenue to get the credibility. But then you build in the infrastructure, and now you can market to big customers like wholesalers, Walmart, Whole Foods, and others, because they're looking for it. They just don't know where to get it, Coleman says. Coleman says information access is especially a struggle for rural and black folks alike. When first installing his own farm's irrigation system years ago, he dismissed the idea of reaching out for government assistance, thinking it would take too long with little payout. That lack of knowledge kept him from saving 50% of the costs. If you've got cable TV in your house, then you can have access to the internet. But then the next is, are you comfortable using the computer? And do you know how to search, he says. It's not a lack of programs, it's a lack of awareness of where these programs exist. Coleman does not have children to inherit his land. The fate of its legacy is uncertain. Currently, he plans for nearby universities to use it for agriculture education. His ancestors who tended this land before him are buried and memorialized near the tree line. He may not be buried on this land, but no matter its future, these markers signify centuries of trauma, perseverance, and grit. He says homegrown nonprofits like Black Soil are paving a clear path forward, and hopefully, dedicated conservation programs like PDR will soon play a hand. The future's bright for those of us who are going to produce a locally grown product where we can sell it directly or as closely as possible to the end consumer, Coleman says. That was the article titled, What It Takes to Keep Kentucky's Black-Led Farms Alive. It was written by Annabelle Peterman and published September 26, 2025, at the website nextcity.com. My final reading is a human interest story titled, Modern Descendants of Georgia Slaves Reflect on Thriving Plantations of Today. This was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on September 28, 2025, and was written by Brooke Lee Howard. Massive plots of land rise to the surface with each rolling hill on the country roads of southern Georgia. In Thomasville, Just minutes from the Florida border, privately owned Antebellum Pebble Hill Plantation continues to thrive in the 21st century with historical tours and event spaces. Nearby, residents sift through a livelihood where the estate doesn't just loom in the background, but acts as a forefront attraction in the community. Sharing fond memories of growing up on land where his ancestors lived in bondage is empowering for James Jack Hatley. Hatley, the grandson of formerly enslaved Richard Hatley Sr., was born on the antebellum period Pebble Hill Plantation in 1936. His family continued to live and work on the property after emancipation. He recalled seasons when the black laborers and their families played baseball games, celebrated Christmas, held church services, and attended schools on the premises. "We always had a big Easter celebration on the plantation," 89-year-old Hatley reminisced on his time growing up at Pebble Hill. Just under a year shy of the country's 250th birthday, black Americans continue to reckon with an America founded on the ideals of freedom that simultaneously shackled their ancestors at fiscal institutions that still stand. Many ponder the purpose and symbolism plantations hold in a modern society, whether those historical landmarks stand as antebellum remnants of nostalgia or as physical reminders that black people were not considered human in a country founded on freedom. Either way, multiple legacies are embedded within the foundational structures of the plantations. Today, the structures are still used as tools for white superiority, says Director of Public History and Historic Preservation at Morehouse College, Karasheek Sims Alvarado, Ph.D. For white people, plantations may reflect a symbol of white superiority that other whites may aspire to achieve. White wealth, white power, white political power, economic power, she says. It's also the romanticization of the South and the Confederacy. Rather than viewing them as elegant mansions and high society, Sims Alvarado, a black woman, says it's important to acknowledge the cruelty that also took place. In May, Louisiana's Nottoway Resort, listed as the largest surviving antebellum plantation, was destroyed by a fire. The place heralded mainly as a popular wedding venue. Nottoway's destruction led to a deeper discussion of pre-Civil War estates where black people were forced to labor. The next part of the article is titled, Reclaiming History. Founded in the early 19th century by Thomas Jefferson Johnson, Pebble Hill was worked by slave labor to farm cotton, corn, sugarcane, and tobacco. After the Civil War, many of the formerly enslaved black Americans stayed on the property and worked as sharecroppers or tenant farmers, even when ownership of the land switched to another family. The black families who had essentially grown up on the property maintained a relationship with the estate, which eventually grew to about 3,000 acres, even after the property changed from being a residential space to a historical site in 1978. Unlike his forefathers, Hatley's life took him in a different direction and away from Pebble Hill Plantation. He enlisted in the U.S. Air Force upon graduating from high school, before returning home to a career with the Postal Service and opening a Black History Museum in Thomasville. This organization's main objective is to get the message to our young people that black Americans have done great things to help build and shape America. Its goals and dreams, the Jack Hatley Black History Museum states on its website. The organization feels that all children, regardless of race, need to know the accomplishments of black men and women in American history. Pebble Hill's Curtis said Hatley's involvement in the history of Pebble Hill has helped boost the interest of other enslaved descendants, which has included a family reunion at the plantation. "Jack is a big part of our storytelling here at Pebble Hill," Curtis said. "It grows every year because more and more people are getting interested in their genealogy," Curtis said. The next part of the article is titled, "It Was Very Emotional." At Gerald Plantation in central Georgia, descendants of the enslaved do not necessarily have on-site reunions like those at Pebble Hill, but many live around the Macon metropolitan area and recognize there could be some relation because of their unique last name. We're proud of who we are, even though our history may have come from a time when things were not acceptable, descendant Ernestine Gerald Brody explained. Nestled on the back roads of Juliet, Gerald Plantation was established in 1847 and grew into a 600-acre cotton plantation labored by enslaved African Americans. After the Civil War and General William Tecumseh Sherman's troops raiding Confederate properties, including Gerald, the Gerald family continued operating and expanding the site until it was donated to the state in 1974. Gerald Brady didn't realize her association with the plantation until she conducted research for a regional cookbook about 40 years ago. She is the great-great-granddaughter of Reason Gerald, the mixed-race son of enslaved Polly and white plantation owner John Fitzgerald. When I was doing my research on my regional cookbook, I actually walked the entire plantation, and I saw the house where Reason lived, Gerald Brady said. It was very emotional. Though acknowledging that she had mixed emotions about the relationship between Polly and the enslaver that she deduced was non-consensual, Gerald Brady said she was proud to know her family's origins. A lot of people don't know where their family lineage started, and I'm just pleased to be able to say that I do. Reason Gerald had a home on the Gerald property, not far from his white relatives. After years of being unoccupied and not maintained, Reason's house was demolished when the plantation became a state-owned historic site. Gerald Brady managed to obtain an old fireplace brick and door hinge before the structure was razed. Those are the only things that were really solid that I could take away and have some type of memory of my great-great-grandfather. The next part of the article is titled, Hiding in Plain Sight. Plantations do not just sit in rural areas outside cities. Within the Atlanta metro, the Archibald Smith Plantation, within walking distance of Roswell City Hall, is free to the public as a National Historic Site. Anthony Gaba Delacroix, who walks by the plantation to get to work at a restaurant, says it's important for black people to know the history of the grounds. Right now, for my feet to be able to walk on this land that our ancestors or past generations have suffered in, there's a kind of freeing sense to that, he said. All of this community that's affluent and very wealthy was built on the backs of our people, and where are they? Similarly, Letitia Whitley of Atlanta, who took her granddaughters to visit Archibald Smith Plantation in June, said she wants the girls to know and understand the complexity of history. There's a place for plantations, for us to understand that these systems of oppression existed, she explained. It's important in today's history. I believe if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. There's a place in the modern day for these particular structures. However, I don't believe that they should be romanticized as some have been. The final part of the article is titled, The Romanticization of the South. Outside of historical tours, there has been a resurgence in the aesthetics of plantation culture. Though the original antebellum structures no longer exist, the Pebble Hill Plantation, which is privately owned, does book private events to help offset property finances, Curtis said. There's a lot of controversy surrounding weddings at plantations. That's all a personal choice, she said, adding that people may not consider how it makes others feel. They don't take into account any of the historical reflection at all. Sims Alvarado, also the founder and chief executive officer of the nonprofit Preserve Black Atlanta Incorporated to save historical landmarks, explained, there were very few whites who actually had very large plantations like in Gone with the Wind. She said, people who celebrate plantations today are attempting to channel a mythological elite lifestyle without recognizing the inhuman practices that took place. They need to understand the horrors. Joseph McGill Jr., a former park ranger who founded the nonprofit history organization, the Slave Dwelling Project, said plantations that continue to operate need to rectify their past by bridging relationships with descendants of the enslaved. Descendants are just looking for that connection to where their families, their ancestors were enslaved, he explained, noting that reparation funds should be collected when plantations charge fees for admission or allow private events like weddings. It was about money then. Keep it about money, McGill said. Tell these wedding planners or these wedding folks who want to have their weddings on plantations that a portion of their wedding fee is going to that reparations fund. Now at 70, Gerald Brady said she and the rest of her family take pride in having ancestral ownership of the Gerald Plantation, but it is still a heavy weight to carry because of the foundations of racial inequality. There's some degree of pride associated with knowing where you come from, but every single day we're reminded, as black people, that we really don't have the freedoms that we think we have, Gerald Brady said. As a child, Hatley's grandfather, Richard, who was mixed race and born enslaved at another Thomasville plantation, was given a bullhorn by his white slave owner father, Simon Hatley Sr. He used the bullhorn to alert those who were enslaved on the plantation when it was time to work in the morning and then again at night. Richard kept the bullhorn until his death in 1910. The bullhorn sat on the mantelpiece when Hatley was growing up. He said he never knew the meaning behind it until he moved back to Thomasville as an adult. Now the bullhorn rests at the museum in honor of Hatley's grandfather and others who made the sacrifice for his freedom. I want the people to be happy to celebrate black history, said Hatley. We survived. We made it. That was the article, Modern Descendants of Georgia Slaves Reflect on Thriving Plantations of Today. This was written by Brooke Lee Howard and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Sunday, September 28, 2025. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.